Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 36.
We're joining Master Tripitaka and his disciples, Sun Wukong, Pigsy, Shamunk, deep into their quest, you know, getting the scriptures from the West.
They've been on their own for years already.
Years. They're traveling along, and again, this huge mountain described as towering and majestic. It just rose up, blocked their path. I mean, for anyone, that's tough after years on the road.
And Tripitaka's reaction, it's just pure exhaustion, fear even.
Totally. The text says he actually cried out right from his horse, full of despair, asking, how can the journey west be so difficult? You know?
You can almost hear the whine in his voice.
And he specifically laments how long it's been. Remembers leaving Changyar, seeing spring, summer, autumn, winter, multiple times.
Yeah.
Counting, what was it, 4 or 5 years?
And still feeling like they're nowhere near the end. You really feel the weight, the emotional toll of this seemingly endless journey.
It's such a human reaction, isn't
yeah.
it? Just weary, overwhelmed. Now, contrast that completely with Wukong.
Okay.
He hears his master lamenting, focusing on the time, the difficulty, and he just laughs.
He laughs at his master's despair.
Well, yeah. The text says, they kind of chuckle. And then he says, it's early yet. It's early. We haven't even left the main hall yet.
Wait, hang on.
Years of travel. Mountains, demons, everything.
Yeah.
And Wukong says they haven't left the main hall.
His perspective is utterly different.
And the others, Pigsy, Shamunk. Oh, they're just as baffled. Pigsy asks, you know, is there really a main hall that big in the human world? Wukong just insists, yeah, they're still just turning around inside it.
So Shamunk thinks he's just bragging.
Yeah, Shamunk laughs, says, come on, brother, basically. You're just boasting. There's no hall like that. Where would you even find beams that big?
Okay, and here's where it gets really interesting. Wukong's cosmic analogy.
This is fantastic. He tells them, look, if you ask Old Monkey, talking about himself, of course, the blue sky is the roof tile.
The sun and moon are the window lattices.
The four mountains and five peaks are the beams and pillars.
And heaven and earth are just one vast open hall.
Wow. Tiandi Yero Yi Chungting.
What a shift in perspective, right? Tripitaka sees the immediate rock, the miles, the years. Wukong takes that huge mountain, the sky, the sun, the moon, symbols of time and space, and puts them all into this single, understandable structure. The universe is a giant hall.
Kind of. It completely reframes the whole quest. Makes the mountain seem, well, not small exactly, but part of a much, much bigger picture. It puts their struggle on a cosmic scale.
Which you can see Pigsy and Shamunk just don't get at all.
Not even close. Pigsy basically throws up his hand, says, forget it. Let's just wander a bit and then go back. You know, they're stuck in the physical reality, the difficulty.
They're not connecting with Wukong's big idea or his commitment, maybe.
Right. And Wukong, he doesn't really dwell on it. He just cuts through the talk, tells them, stop talking nonsense, just follow me. And then he acts.
Takes his iron staff, steps forward, and literally cuts open the mountain path, Pukai Shanlu, just physically pushes them forward into the obstacle. Very decisive.
So they actually go into the mountain. And the description changes, doesn't it? From these huge cosmic ideas back to, well, intensely wild details. Very wild. Tripitaka looks around, sees peaks so high they seem to scrape the stars, trees reaching the clouds, mist everywhere, apes crying, cranes calling. It's atmospheric.
But also kind of forbidding.
Definitely. The text mentions dangers, like wind-howling mountain demons standing by the stream playing with woodcutters, and formed fox spirits sitting on cliff edges, startling hunters. It emphasizes a harsh, untamed place, rough cliffs, old, dead-looking trees covered in vines, cold, rushing water, strong winds.
You can almost hear it, too, right? Tigers roaring, birds singing fiercely, deer and boar crashing through the undergrowth.
And here's a really key line. The text flat-out states it's entirely a ground for flying birds and running beasts.
Okay.
And then adds, pointedly, it should not be a place for the Buddha to cultivate. It's explicitly defined as wild, not spiritual, not the kind of place they're ultimately seeking.
Which, understandably, really gets to Tripitaka.
Oh, deeply. The text says he was trembling with fear when they went into this deep mountain. His heart felt sad and miserable. He's just overwhelmed by the raw wildness. I mean, the feeling that it's unholy ground.
And this leads to that really strange moment.
Oh, yeah, yes. That list. He stops his horse, calls for Wukong, and then just recites this list of, well, traditional Chinese medicine names.
Yeah, Yizi, Wenbuli, Xing, Senlenzi, Meduling, Jinji, Fuling, Fengji, Zuli, Huxang.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Coming right at this moment of deep despair, longing for home, he ends by asking when he'll ever get back to court. Why medicines?
It feels like, I don't know, maybe he sees the hardship, or himself even, as being sick, needing a cure, and the only cure is finishing the journey, getting back to safety. It feels very personal, almost like a coded cry for help.
It's a powerful moment of vulnerability, so different from his disciples. And Wukong's reaction, another laugh, but this time the text specifically calls it a cold laugh.
That single word adds so much. It raises questions, doesn't it? Is he just exasperated with Tripitaka?
Or is it just Wukong's nature, detached from these human emotions? Given his cosmic view just moments before, maybe he sees Tripitaka's fear as small, petty even.
The text gives us that detail, that chill, and Wukong just tells him, basically, don't worry, don't fret, just keep going.
Success will come naturally. It's classic Wukong. Blunt, goal-oriented, not much sympathy on display.
So they're cushioning through this intense, wild place. The day's ending, the sun's setting.
Yeah, the red wheel of the sun going down. And as evening comes, the text paints this beautiful contrasting picture, the wider world settling into peace, completely unlike where they are.
Right, you hear about 10 long pavilions with no travelers, the 9 heavens showing stars, boats docked, city gates closing.
Officials heading home, fishermen stopping their work. Mm-hmm. You hear evening bells, drums.
And a round bright moon fills the universe.
It's just this image of order, peace, normal life, highlighting how far removed they are.
And in that quiet moonlight, still on his horse, Tripitaka looks into a hollow in the mountain and sees buildings.
Finally. Layered towers and multi-storied halls.
A glimmer of hope.
He must have been so relieved. He immediately thinks it's got to be a temple, right? A monastery? Somewhere to stay.
After that awful wild mountain, the thought of sanctuary, yeah, must have been huge. Wukong agrees it looks promising, but you know Wukong, he says, hang on, I'll check it out first.
There was a scout, so he jumps up into the air.
Great sage leaps up, gets a good look, and confirms, yep, it's a temple gate.
And the description we get then is quite grand, isn't it?
Surprisingly detailed. Red painted walls, gold nails on the gates, layered buildings, specific halls named 10,000 Buddhist Pavilion, Tathagatgata Hall, a 7-story pagoda.
Halls for Manjushri and Maitreya. It sounds important. Very. It's described in really elevated language, like a place where the forest shelters the ground of the three jewels and the mountain embraces the palace of the Brahma King.
Linji San Baodi, Shan Yong Fang Wang Gong.
Wow. So it's presented as this...
It seems like exactly the kind of refuge Tripitaka was hoping for.
So Wukong lands... Confirms it's a temple, good place to stay. They head for the gate.
And the first thing Tripitaka does when they get there, asks Wukong what the temple's called.
And Wukong, of course, has to tease him a bit.
Naturally. He points out, you know, Master, you've been a monk since you were a kid. You studied the classics, practiced the Dharma. You got favor from the Tang King.
Yeah.
Surely you can read the big sign on the gate.
It's a gentle poke, maybe. Reminding him of who he is, but also maybe teasing him for being too flustered to even read a sign.
Tripitaka makes an excuse. Blames the setting sun, dust on the sign.
Which leads to one of those great visual Wukong moments. Oh, yeah. Without a word, he just sort of bends down, makes himself grow. Over 2 zhang tall.
That's huge.
Huge. Reaches up and just brushes the dust off the gate plaque with his hand. Simple as that.
Revealing the name, clear as day.
Imperially built Baolin Temple. Qijian Baolin Si.
Imperially built. That's key, isn't it?
Definitely adds significance. This isn't just any temple. It was commissioned by the emperor. It's official. Wukong shrinks back down and asks, okay, who's going in to ask for lodging?
And Tripitaka makes a really telling decision here. He says he'll go alone.
Yeah, and his reason. He's surprisingly blunt about it. He has Wukong and the others, well, they're ugly.
Harsh.
Their speech is rude, Yan Yukusu, and their arrogant, stubborn Ixing Geng Kiao. He's worried they'll offend the monks inside.
And get turned away, which, after the day they've had, would be awful.
Exactly. So it gives you this fascinating insight into how Tripitaka sees his companions, their looks, their manners, potential liabilities, in this kind of polite, spiritual place. He takes the responsibility himself.
And Wukong. He just accepts it.
Pretty much. Just says, okay, if that's how it is, Master, please go in. No need for more words. Tang monk arrives at this place, the Baolin Temple. First thing he sees are these big statues at the gate. The Vajra Guardians. The text says they have iron faces and steel beards, bronze-like palms. That's pretty intense.
Oh, they are. They're meant to be imposing, like, spiritual protectors, keeping out bad energy. But what's really interesting is Tang Monk's immediate thought.
What's that?
He sees this dedication, and he thinks, wow, if people back east were this devoted, I wouldn't even need to make this whole journey west.
Huh. That's telling, isn't it? Right at the start. Shows he's maybe a bit homesick, or at least comparing everything to an ideal he has.
Yeah, a sense of displacement, maybe a longing for that ideal world. Then he goes further in, sees more statues, the four heavenly kings.
Right. Arshur, Sight, got the names and everything.
Right.
Associated with wind and rain. Very specific.
Very traditional. These aren't just decorations. They're significant figures, protectors of the directions. It builds this picture of a, well, a proper sacred place.
Mm-hmm. And there are these four big pine trees, too, like umbrellas leading to the main hall. It sounds quite beautiful, actually, Serene.
It does. It's an expectation, doesn't it? Power, protection, reverence. This is what a holy place should be like.
So Tang Monk, being who he is, goes into the main hall, the Tang, and prostrates before the Buddha. Just as you'd expect.
Standard practice for him. Respectful.
But then in the rear hall, there's this image of Guan Yin Bodhisattva. It's called Xi, Saving Beings in the South Sea. And the details sound amazing. Sculptures of shrimp, fish, crabs, turtles, all looking reverent.
Yeah, and that sparks another thought in him. He sees these, you know, creatures with scales and shells showing devotion.
Right.
And it makes him wonder, why don't humans who are supposedly more capable try harder to cultivate themselves spiritually? It's a subtle critique.
Interesting. So he's having this quite profound spiritual experience looking at the art and the setup of the temple.
Pretty much. He's in his element thinking deep thoughts.
And then things change. A Taoist priest shows up.
Right. No, it's worth remembering, Taoism and Buddhism existed side by side in China. So finding a Taoist in a Buddhist temple isn't totally out of the blue.
Okay, good context. But the text notes the priest clocks Tang Monk's unusual appearance and extraordinary demeanor. So he stands out immediately.
He does. He looks different. And their first chat is, well, polite on the surface.
Tang Monk explains who he is, where he's from, the Tang Dynasty, and why he's traveling. You know, the big mission.
Yeah.
Go west, get the scriptures, a huge undertaking for his people.
Seeking wisdom, enlightenment. It's a noble cause.
And he just asks for lodging for the night. Basic request.
But the Taoist priest says, oh, I'm just, you know, a helper here. Sweeping floors, ringing bells. I can't give permission. You need to talk to the boss, the Ursia, the managing senior monk.
Ah, okay. So there's a hierarchy. He doesn't have the authority.
Exactly. That detail becomes pretty important very quickly. It shows rank matters here.
So the Taoist goes off to tell the senior monk that Ursia, and here's where the vibe just completely shifts.
Mm-hmm, big shift.
The senior monk is all dressed up first, puts on a special hat, the Varwakana hat, and his formal kasaya robe. Like he's preparing for someone important.
Showing his status, setting a formal tone.
But then he asks the Taoist priest, kind of dismissively, where are you from? And the priest just points at Tang Monk.
And we get this description of Tang Monk at that moment. Bareheaded, simple robe, a 25 stripes Dharma robe, which sounds traditional, but maybe plain and muddy sandals.
Yeah, the text says oogle candy tree, basically muddy traveling shoes. He looks like he's been on the road because he has.
He looks exactly like a traveling monk.
But the senior monk just explodes. He yells at the Taoist priest like, how could you bother me for this guy? Basically calls him lowly.
Ouch.
He says, I only greet important officials from the city, the ones who bring donations, who offer incense.
It's pure prejudice based on appearance, isn't it? And social status. He sees the simple clothes, the mud, and just assumes the worst.
Totally. He doesn't ask who Tang Monk is or why he's there. He just jumps to, this guy's untrustworthy, probably just wants a free bed and meal.
A wandering monk looking for a handout. That's the assumption.
And he tells him to wait out in the front corridor.
Yeah.
Like, shoo, go wait over there. Don't bother me.
Demeaning, really. Treating him like a beggar.
Yeah. And you can imagine how Tang Monk feels. The text says he felt that whole who are thing, people are worth less when they're far from home. Hits hard.
That feeling of being devalued, misunderstood.
He has this whole internal argument, like, wait a minute. I don't do bad things. I study scripture sincerely. I respect this place. He came from a place of respect on this vital mission and gets this.
He's bewildered. He laments encountering unkind people. And then for a split second, he thinks about mentioning his disciple, Sun Wukong.
Ah, the monkey hand.
Yeah, like a little flash of frustration, maybe a veiled threat. Like, you wouldn't treat me like this if you knew who I travel with. But he catches himself and probably realizes Wukong would just smash the place up.
Yeah, probably wise. But despite being treated so rudely, he still clings to courtesy. People should prioritize propriety and etiquette. So he decides, okay, I need to talk to this guy directly. So he follows the Taoist towards the abbot's quarters, the Gyuda, but he doesn't just barge in.
No, he stops respectfully in the courtyard, the shir, and calls out.
And inside, the senior monk is just sitting there, robes loosened. Looks like he's busy with paperwork. Very casual, very dismissive. Not exactly welcoming.
The contrast is really strong. Tang monk outside, being formal and humble. Senior monk inside, radiating indifference.
Tang monk repeats himself. I'm from the Tang dynasty. I'm going west for the scriptures. Can I please just stay the night? I'll leave early, promise.
Polite, clear, reasonable.
The senior monk finally acknowledges him using his proper title, Fang Senzang. So he knows who he is, or at least the name.
But there's still no respect there. He even makes a snarky comment like, oh, so you don't know the way.
And then suggests he go find a lodging house down the road, basically telling him to get lost.
Right, not the welcome you'd expect at a monastery.
This pushes Tang monk a bit. He appeals to tradition, saying, hey, monasteries like this are supposed to be resting places for monks like me. We're usually even given a bit of rice. He asks him straight up, why are you being like this? What's the reason?
Good question. Puts him on the spot.
And the senior monk's response. He accuses Tang monk of being glib-tongued, slick talker.
Basically accuses him of trying to talk his way into getting something.
Tang monk just asks innocently, what does that mean?
And that's when the senior monk finally explains himself, gives his reasons for being so suspicious and unwelcoming.
He uses a proverb. When a tiger enters the city, every household closes its doors. Although it may not bite now, its reputation is already ruined. Meaning, past bad experiences have ruined it for everyone else.
The bad apple spoils the bunch argument.
Exactly. He then tells this story about previous wandering monks who stayed at the temple. He says they took advantage, got lazy, caused trouble for years.
And it gives specifics, doesn't he? It's not just vague complaints.
No, it's a whole list. Throwing roof tiles, pulling nails out of things, breaking windows for firewood.
Okay, that's pretty bad.
Blocking paths with doors, using temple banners for shoe straps, stealing incense, spilling lamp oil, even gambling using temple cups and bowls.
Wow. Okay, so he's painting a picture of some really badly behaved monks causing chaos and disrespecting the place entirely.
Yeah. It explains his defensiveness, right? His past experience was genuinely awful.
It explains it, but does it excuse judging Tang monk, who's done none of those things, purely based on being another traveling monk?
That's the crux of it. The senior monk is letting the actions of those past monks completely color his view of Tang monk now. It's prejudice born from bad experience.
And how does Tang monk react to hearing this story?
Silently. The text says he's just dismayed. He thinks, oh dear, would my own disciples ever behave so badly? He's upset, almost crying, but tries not to show it.
He internalizes it, doesn't argue, doesn't defend himself for it.
Nope. He just quietly leaves the abbot's quarters and goes back to find his disciples. His hope for respectful welcome completely dashed.
But when he comes back, something's clearly off.
Yeah, he seems troubled, kind of hesitant. And all he says at first is that it's inconvenient.
Inconvenient. Not exactly welcoming, is it?
No. And that word inconvenient, it immediately signals something's up. It's not just no vacancy.
It feels like something maybe he finds difficult or even, I don't know, embarrassing to explain properly.
Right. And that hesitation, it immediately gets Sun Wukong's attention.
Oh, yeah. Wukong sees his master's upset. Pigsy apparently even hears a kind of crying sound in his voice.
And Wukong, being Wukong, you know, he doesn't do vague. He presses him.
Were you hit? Cursed?
But no, just inconvenient.
Wukong's first thought, maybe, is it's the wrong kind of establishment. Maybe Taoist.
Yeah, he seems to suspect that initially. But Tang Sanzang corrects him pretty fast, make that distinction clear.
Right. The quote, Taoists are only in Taoist temples. Temples only have monks.
So, okay, it's fellow monks making things inconvenient.
Now, Wukong really smells a rat. Or maybe just realizes his master isn't cut out for this particular kind of negotiation.
He basically tells Tang Sanzang, step aside.
I'll go inside and take a look. And you just know that means trouble brewing for whoever's inside.
And that really sets the stage. It's anything but subtle. Because Wukong's entrance.
He bursts right into the main Buddha hall, iron staff already out.
And his first move isn't even talking to a person. He talks to the statues.
It's pretty wild, isn't it? He addresses the three big Buddha statues, not with reverence, but with, well, blunt impatience.
Calls them mud sculptures with gold plating, fake images. He basically asks if they have any spiritual spark at all.
He's kind of bypassing the monks entirely, going straight to the symbolic top, demanding they arrange lodging.
For the Tang monk,
yep.
Emphasizing the importance of the scripture-seeking mission.
And then comes the threat. if they don't sort it out,
they'll smash their golden bodies with one blow, turn them back into their original form of mud.
Wow. So what does that tell us right off the bat about how Wukong sees authority or, you know, the sacred?
Well, it seems he sees power as a functional. It has to do something. These statues, symbols of ultimate authority, they're just gilded clay to him if they aren't helping the real mission.
So the journey's purpose trumps traditional reverence for him.
Absolutely, right from the start. And that display, even towards statues, it signals he's ready to escalate things fast.
And that readiness, it quickly affects the living. While he's doing this, a doorman comes in to light incense.
Wukong just lets out this sharp yell duo.
Yeah.
And scares the poor guy so badly he falls right over.
And then when the doorman finally scrambles up and actually sees Wukong's face.
He falls over again. Just pure terror.
Then he stumbles off to report this, well, apparition to the senior monk, the Sangwan.
The senior monk is understandably a bit skeptical at first. Probably thinks it's just some rowdy visitor.
But the doorman insists. This one's different, and he gives that really vivid description.
Born fierce and irritable, without a backbone in attitude. That's quite a phrase.
And the physical details, too. Round eyes, pointed ears, hairy face, thunder god mouth.
Plus, crucially, he's armed and looking for a fight. This isn't just someone who looks strange. He looks dangerous.
So the senior monk decides he needs to see this for himself. He goes to the door, opens it.
And the sight of Wukong is apparently even worse than the description?
Yeah, the source gives us that other incredible kind of grotesque portrait. Ugly, uneven face, yellow eyes, a dented forehead.
Fangs sticking outwards, like a crab. Meat inside, bone outside. That crab image.
It really sticks, doesn't it? All that hardness and danger right there on the surface.
The powerful way to convey something alien, something threatening.
Yeah.
And the senior monk's reaction. Pure instinct.
Fear. He just slams the door shut right in Wukong's face.
Which is, you know, probably the worst thing you could do to Wukong.
Oh, yeah. He chases after the monk, smashes the door down anyway. Oh.
And now he's inside their private space, and he just ramps up the demand dramatically.
It quickly. Clean 1,000 clean rooms. This old son is sleeping.
1,000 rooms. And the source text even gives us the senior monk's internal reaction to that.
Right. He's thinking the entire temple complex, halls, towers, quarters, abbot's quarters, it doesn't even add up to 300 rooms.
So the demand isn't just unreasonable. It's physically impossible.
So the monks, they just fall back on the original excuse. Repeat the inconvenience thing.
Say their small, desolate mountain temple dare not host such important guests, suggest they go somewhere else.
It really feels like the inconvenience is less about logistics and more about just sheer discomfort or fear.
Exactly. And this refusal, this flimsy excuse, it just makes Wukong switch tactics.
He doesn't argue about the room count. He just flips the script.
Makes his iron staff enormous. Basin thick, the text says, and stands it upright in the courtyard.
Just this colossal iron pillar right there. And the message is blunt.
If you find it inconvenient, monks, then you can move out.
Huh? Just like that.
The senior monk tries to push back then. Appeals to their history, their rights.
Says the temple is their hereditary home, passed down generation to generation.
You know, they've lived there since they were kids.
There are 400 or 500 of them, our bankris. They've got nowhere else to go.
It's their home, their whole community, their world.
And Wukong's response to this plea...
ignores it completely. Escalates again.
Demands one monk come out for a sample stick.
Basically threatening to beat one of them as a demonstration. A warning.
Which naturally sends them into even more panic.
The old monk even tries to shove the doorman forward. Cites that proverb, raise an army for 1,000 days, use it for one morning.
Like, you work here, you take the hit.
But the doorman is terrified, points out how huge the staff is if it fell.
It would crush them into meat paste.
And the senior monk agrees. Even just standing there, if you ran into it in the dark courtyard, you'd get a big hole.
They fully understand the physical danger here.
And Wukong, listening to them freaking out, seems to make a strategic decision.
He realizes actually hitting someone might upset his master, right?
Exactly. He thinks Tang Sanzang would disapprove of him actually being violent towards the monks.
So terror is fine, but actual physical assault on them might cross a line for his master.
So he needs another demonstration. Something just as terrifying, but not directed at a person.
And he spots it, a stone lion outside the abbot's quarters. Perfect target.
Inanimate. Expendable.
And with just one blow, he smashes it.
Into hug, powdered, jumbled pieces, utterly destroyed.
And that does it. That act just shatters the monk's remaining resistance.
The source says they were Eka bones soft, tendons numb with fear.
They scatter, hiding under beds, trying to squeeze into the stove.
It's almost darkly funny, the extremity of their fear.
And suddenly the tune changes completely, no more inconvenient.
Now it's, Grandpa, the stick is heavy, heavy. Cannot bear it. Convenient, convenient.
Oh, it's very convenient now.
The power dynamic has completely flipped. Wukong's in total control.
He demands the exact number of monks.
And they tell him straight away. 285 sections, 500 ordained monks.
And Wukong lays down his final order, non-negotiable.
All 500 monks dressed properly in their long robes need to come out immediately.
To welcome Tang San Zhang to the abbot's quarters.
And if they do that, he promises he won't hit them.
The senior monk, completely cowed now, promises they'll comply. Says they'll even carry Tang San Zhang in if needed. Do you? Just don't hit us.
Wukong just tells him to hurry up.
The poor doorman, still terrified, gets told to go round everyone up, even if his heart is, quote, breaking from fear.
And there's that little detail that really shows his terror. He crawls out through a dog hole to avoid the main door where Wukong is.
Finds his way to the main hall, sounds the bells and drums together, an unusual signal.
Gets everyone's attention. Monks rush in, confused.
The doorman tells them, quick, get dressed, line up outside the main gate, welcome the Tang Dynasty Lao Ye.
And the source gives us this fascinating little insight into their clothing as they scramble.
Yeah, they pull on various robes, the kasaya, the panshan, the ziduo, which is described colorfully as like a one-piece bell.
But then there's the note about the monks, who are extremely poor.
They don't have proper long robes, so they've improvised.
Joined skirt panels together. Yeah, UDU, making these sort of makeshift robes.
Wukong actually notices these patched together outfits, asks what they are.
And they explain they made these ought-wrapped poverty garments themselves from donated cloth because they couldn't afford a tailor.
And Wukong, who moments before was this, you know, terrifying force of nature,
finds this detail quietly amusing.
It's just a brief flash of his complexity, isn't it? Noticing this very human, kind of sad detail amidst all the chaos he caused.
Yeah. Then he makes sure all 500 monks, the mix of formally robed and these wrapped poverty figures, are kneeling outside the gate.
The senior monk, now totally deferential, calls out, Tang Lao Ye, please sit in the abbot's quarters.
The inconvenience has completely vanished. Problem solved.
Classic Wukong, using fear as a tool. Even Baji pipes up about it, doesn't he?
He does. He asks Tang Monk something like, how did Wukong manage to be so cunning to get them bowing when the master couldn't even get the door opened?
And what's interesting is Tang Monk actually defends Wukong here.
Right. He quotes that same proverb Wukong used. It shows he gets it, maybe reluctantly, but he understands that this journey sometimes requires, well, more than just gentleness.
So the monks come out. And their reaction to Wukong?
Oh, it's immediate. Pure fear. They start kowtowing like crazy, begging him not to use his big staff.
And Wukong's reply is just perfect. Something like, I haven't hit you yet.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the threat is definitely implied.
Uh-huh.
And just like that, their attitude does a complete 180.
From refusal to, what, overly helpful.
Totally. Suddenly, they're falling over themselves to help, leading the horse, carrying the luggage. The text even says they offer to carry Tang Monk and Baiji themselves.
Wow. Talk about hospitality under duress.
Absolutely. They lead them into the abbot's quarters, and the bowing just continues.
But Tang Monk, being who he is, tries to stop them, right? He reminds them, hey, we're all fellow Buddhist disciples here. No need for all this.
He does. He's focused on that spiritual equality. But the monks, they're still operating out of fear, I think. It's all about appeasement now.
The monk official even apologizes. Admitting they were common-eyed, basically saying they didn't recognize Tang Monk's importance at first.
Yeah, until Wukong forcefully pointed out, their initial judgment was completely superficial.
Then comes this seemingly simple question about food, vegetarian or meat?
Tang Monk naturally says vegetarian.
But the monk official, he kind of hesitates when it comes to Wukong.
Right. He specifically asks about him and addresses him as Grandpa. It sounds respectful, but you can feel the fear behind it, can't you?
Definitely. Like, surely this fierce-looking guy eats meat?
They clearly assume so based on his appearance and, well, his actions just moments before.
And Wukong throws them another curveball.
He does. He declares, nope, we're all vegetarian. And he uses this specific term, S, Vegetarian from the womb. Since birth, lifelong vegetarians.
And the monks are just stunned. The text captures it perfectly. Grandpa, this fierce guy is also vegetarian.
Uh-huh, yeah. It totally shatters their assumptions, forces them, just for a second, to see past the scary exterior.
So, okay, things seem maybe slightly calmer until they ask about how much food to make.
Ah, yes. Enter Baji.
He doesn't miss his chance, does he? First, he insults them, calls them
small-minded monks. Yeah, a bit rude.
And then makes this completely over-the-top demand for rice.
An absurd amount.
It's pure Baji, isn't it? Partly about the food, maybe partly a little payback for being snubbed earlier.
Could be. He's definitely using the leverage Wukong created, but for, you know, purely physical satisfaction.
Yeah.
And maybe a bit of gluttonous mischief.
And the monks just panic and rush off to cook this mountain of rice.
You got it. So eventually they eat, thank the temple, and it's time to sort out sleeping arrangements. They get 3 Zen halls prepared.
And Wukong, ever the practical one.
Exactly. He brings the horse inside the hall with them, gets some fodder, and tells the temple servants they can go. He's not taking any chances after the initial welcome, securing their transport and supplies.
But then there's this other weird moment. Tang Monk is sitting there trying to settle down, and the text says there are 500 temple monks just standing around inside the hall.
Yeah, just lingering, not leaving.
Why are they doing that? Still scared, trying too hard to be attentive.
Probably a mix of both. Lingering fear of Wukong, plus this overtop deference. Now they think they know who Tang Monk is, or at least who travels with them. They don't want to mess up again.
Tang Monk has to ask them to leave several times so he can rest.
Right. The official tells him to wait until he's settled, but Tang Monk finally insists, look, I am settled, please go. It really shows how forced and unnatural their hospitality is.
So they finally leave. Later that night, things quiet down. Tang Monk steps outside.
And he's struck by the moonlight. The text uses the phrase, you.
Homesick while looking at the moon.
Exactly. And he recites this long, beautiful, classical poem. It's full of emotion, thoughts about the landscape, history, and just longing for home, for Changan.
It's a very human moment for him, grounding him despite the epic quest. A bit of quiet after all the chaos.
It really is. But then Wukong responds, and he takes it somewhere completely different.
He acknowledges the moon's beauty, sure, but then he calls it a, what was the phrase?
Right. A rule or guide of innate cosmic patterns or celestial forms.
Yeah.
He immediately shifts from the emotional to the metaphysical.
What's he get at there?
This is pure Wukong, the cultivator.
Mm.
He's drawing on Taoist alchemy ideas. He sees the moon phases, new moon, first quarter, full moon, last quarter, not just as astronomy, but as a symbol of the cosmic dance of yin and yang.
The fundamental forces.
Exactly. And he links this directly to their journey. He talks about cultivating essence and energy and achieving Wukong. Success after 81 trials, the destined number of challenges they have to face. Wukong is saying, if you understand and align yourself with these cosmic cycles, this internal cultivation,
then seeing the Buddha and getting home becomes easy.
That's the idea. His little poem sums it up. Refine yourself internally, refining in the furnace, and you'll reach the goal, the West.
And how does Tang Monk react to this unexpected lesson from Wukong?
He gets it. The text says he experiences enlightenment, understanding. He's joyful, thanks Wukong. It's a real aha moment for him, sparked by Wukong's wisdom.
Wow. But it doesn't even stop there, does it? Xiao Monk adds his perspective.
Right. Old San, he agrees with the cycle idea, but adds another layer. He talks about balancing water and fire through.
More alchemy talk.
Definitely. Water and fire are key energies, often volatile. And he says they need to be mediated by earth, Mekong. Earth is the harmonizing element.
So it's about balance and harmony.
Precisely. His poem emphasizes that 3 elements meet without fighting, and Hong Kong, water in the river, moon in the sky. It's about interconnectedness, finding that unity.
And this deepens Tang Monk's understanding even more. He feels his spiritual dullness or blockages opening up.
Yes. And the text gives us those incredibly potent lines. Simon.
Whoa.
Which means, roughly, understand one principle and 1,000 insights open up. Speaking of the unborn and arising, is achieving immortality. It's hitting at a core Buddhist idea, realizing the fundamental nature of reality, emptiness, is liberation itself.
So this whole moon scene, It takes something simple and just explodes it into layers of meaning about their inner journey. It's not just about walking west.
Not at all. It's about self-refinement, balancing internal energies, gaining profound wisdom. It's incredibly deep.
Just as they're reaching these profound spiritual heights.
Crash, here comes Baji.
The ultimate reality check. He literally pulls Tang Monk and tells him to stop listening to this.
Nonsense or random talk. He has zero time for the philosophy.
His view of the moon is, well, very Baji.
Completely. He just sees it waxing and waning and compares it to himself. Like, I wasn't born perfect either.
He starts complaining about his big belly, sticky hands.
Yeah, all the things he gets criticized for. He contrasts their cleverness with his own perceived stupidity.
Does his perspective serve a real purpose here, beyond just being funny?
Oh, absolutely. He's the anchor. He pulls everything back down to earth. While the others are contemplating cosmic truths, Baji's worried about his flaws and feeling hungry. He reminds us, and them, that this journey involves physical hardship, dealing with imperfections. He keeps it grounded.
You need that balance, I suppose.
You do. His final poem is just priceless, too, basically saying, yeah, we'll finish our karma and then just wag our tails and heads and go straight to heaven.
Sort of a sarcastic, let's just get this over with vibe.
Exactly. It perfectly captures his mindset. Endure, get the reward, skip the hard internal work if possible. Such a contrast to the others.
So after Baji effectively ends the moon appreciation session, Tang Monk agrees the disciples should sleep. They're tired.
But he decides to stay up. Says he wants to read a scripture.
Which confuses Wukong, right?
Right.
Wukong asks him, essentially, Master, you've been a monk forever. You're going for the ultimate scriptures. Why study now? Why review the basics?
It's a fair question. Tang Monk says because they travel so much, he's afraid he's forgotten some of the earlier scriptures he learned. And now, luckily, tonight he has some leisure time he wants to review them.